Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you.
Dr. Greedy graduated from the National University Galway in 2008. She then went on to obtain membership to the Royal College of Physicians, where she completed the higher specialist training in medical oncology. In 2016, she was the recipient of a fellowship to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Centre, New York. Dr. Greedy has a clinical research focus in gastrointestinal malignancies and has presented her research at multiple international meetings. She has authored and co-authored several publications in colorectal cancer.
She joins us today to discuss colorectal cancer. We speak about what colorectal cancer is, the signs and symptoms, treatments available, and the different stages and mutations that may be present. As one of Dr. Greeley's patients said before, she breaks down cancer into a language we can all understand, which is something we can definitely vouch for after our conversation today.
Unfortunately, the first question that we asked Dr. Greeley didn't record properly, so Anne-Marie is going to answer the first question, and then we will continue on with the rest of the interview. So Anne-Marie, what is colorectal cancer and how common is it in Ireland?
So colorectal cancer is a cancer that starts in the colon, or the bowel as it's also known, or the rectum. Colon and rectal cancer are usually grouped together because they are in continuity and have many features in common. In Ireland, it is the third most common cancer in men and the fifth most common in women.
Good morning, Dr. Greeley, and thank you so much. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us today about colorectal cancer. If you don't mind, we will get straight into it.
What would be some of the early signs and symptoms that people can look out for?
So this, you know, it's important where the cancer is in the bowel, in terms of thinking about what symptoms you might have. So if it's a left-sided cancer in the colon, or indeed down into the rectum, people often have a change in their bowel habits, so constipation or diarrhea, which can alternate with each other. And again, if it's a cancer that's lower down in the bowel near the rectum, people can have thin stool and a sensation that we refer to as tenesmus, which means that you don't feel after evacuating your bowels that you have fully done so. And the other symptom that's common with tumors that occur lower down in the bowel and in the rectum is blood in the stool that's visible and appears fresh. If you have tumors that are located more in the right colon, people sometimes can have crampy pain in their abdomen, or they can present indeed with anemia because of slow chronic blood loss that isn't visible. And so the symptoms of anemia would be, you know, fatigue and lethargy and feeling weak. And then more acutely, sometimes patients can present with acute symptoms of obstruction or perforation, where they can be very unwell and need to be admitted to the hospital for urgent care.
Okay. And who would we consider high risk for colorectal cancer?
I would break this into, you know, non-modifiable factors that we can't do things about as such. So that would be people with inherited conditions. The most common inherited condition that predisposes us to bowel cancer is Lynch syndrome. And then increasing age, people with a family history of bowel cancer, but not necessarily associated with Lynch syndrome. People who have a history of inflammatory bowel disease, meaning Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And then more rarely would be patients with a history of who have received radiation to their abdomen. And then things that we can do something about would be having elevated weight or obesity, our alcohol intake, smoking, lack of physical activity. And there has been an association with increased intake of red meat.
Okay. So in Ireland, we have a bowel screening program. What does this involve and who would be eligible for this?
Yes, and it's one of the more recent screening programs that have that has opened. And the idea is really that if you detect a bowel cancer at an earlier stage, it's easier to treat. And it may be that people can avoid more intensive treatments such as chemotherapy or radiation. So in Ireland, at the moment, it is targeted at people who are aged 60 to 69. And we do it every 2 years. So what is involved is a post postage of a sample to collect your stool at home. And this test is called an FOB test. So it basically then looks to see if you have any blood present in the stool. And if you do, you are referred for colonoscopy for further evaluation.
Okay, perfect. You just mentioned Lynch syndrome in the previous question. Do you mind just explaining a little bit about what Lynch syndrome is?
Yes, so Lynch syndrome, as I mentioned, is the most common genetically inherited condition that predisposes us to colon cancer. What it is a germline mutation in some of our DNA genes. When I say germline, what I mean is it's something that was inherited from either our father or our mother. The mutation in the DNA gene is in something called MMR, or mismatch repair. And the role of this system in our bodies is to maintain the genome, the integrity of the genome. So if it finds errors in our genes, it corrects these mismatches when our DNA is replicating or dividing. It's basically a genetic signature that we inherit, and then this in turn makes the cells less stable, and increases our risk of developing colorectal cancer. But there is a risk of other malignancies as well, which is important to be mindful of, including endometrial cancer. So if we take a patient with colorectal cancer or endometrial cancer, the chance of finding Lynch syndrome in that patient cohort is about 3%. Other cancers that are increased with Lynch syndrome include kidney cancers and cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, such as stomach cancers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we know that cancer is broken into four stages. What is stage one colorectal cancer and how is it treated?
So stage one is obviously the earliest stage of colorectal cancer and associated with the best prognosis. It means that you do not have any lymph glands involved, that the cancer cells have not yet spread to lymph glands, but equally the cancer cells have not spread deep into the bowel wall. So we have four layers in our bowel wall. And if you have stage one cancer, it means that it has only grown into the first or second layer.
Okay.
And the treatment for this is surgery, in general, surgery alone, to remove the tumor, and no further chemotherapy or radiation is generally required.
Brilliant. And what about stage two colorectal cancer? I think it's broken down into A, B and C. Could we elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. So it comes down to how deep into the bowel wall the cancer has grown. Again, patients with stage two colon cancers do not have lymph gland involvement. So a stage 2A cancer, for example, means that the tumor is T3, having grown into the third layer of bowel. If it's 2B or 2C, it means that it has grown out through the bowel wall. T2C means that it has involved another organ, such as, okay, say, the bladder or the uterus in a woman. Okay, so it's just increasing levels of growth out through the bowel wall. But as I mentioned, importantly, no lymph glands involved. So again, the treatment for this would be primarily surgery. But there is a grey area as to whether we should proceed with preventative chemotherapy to try and stop the cancer coming back in the future. And oncologists don't always agree on the merits of proceeding with preventative chemotherapy in this situation, because the benefits are small. And so we have to treat a lot of patients with, a period of 3 to 6 months of chemotherapy, so that a small few won't get the cancer back. And obviously that comes with side effects and toxicity, you know. So it really is a patient discussion about weighing up the pros and cons. There are certain features where we do more strongly consider chemotherapy, and these include patients who have tumor cells that look high grade under the microscope, meaning that they appear to be dividing more quickly than tumor cells, which we refer to as lower grade. If patients have lymphovascular invasion, which is where we can see under the microscope again that there are cells in the lymphatic system or the blood vessels within the tumor, suggesting that it has an ability to escape into the lymph glands or the bloodstream. and spread. The other times we might consider it is if the surgeon has not been able to take more than 12 lymph glands, so we don't have a good representative sample to say that this is truly a node negative tumour. And then the other important time we would consider it is if a patient presents with acutely with an obstruction, so a blockage in their bowel or a perforation, because that is associated with a higher risk of recurrence in the future. The other very important thing as well with surgery is that the margins are clear from where the tumor was taken. So if, you know, we want to know that there are no cells left behind, which also would obviously make us more likely to consider chemotherapy if the margins were what we refer to as positive.
Okay.
And in terms of what type of treatment we might consider, it's often just one chemotherapy drug on its own, being 5-FU or capecitabine. And sometimes, again, in the higher risk patients who are have a good performance status, we might consider 6 months of oxaliplatin plus 5-FU or capecitabine. The important caveat as well is that all of these patients with stage 2 cancer should have an MMR test, because if you are found to have MMR deficiency, which can also be, is also what we see in Lynch syndrome, these patients generally will not benefit from 5-FU or capecitabine chemotherapy on its own, and generally have a better prognosis. But if we were going to consider chemotherapy in this group, the evidence would suggest that it should be oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy.
Okay. And is that test a biopsy, is it?
It's done on the samples taken by the surgeon at surgery, or the original biopsy diagnosis. It's a standard test that's done with the pathologist.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So going further into stage 3 colorectal cancer, this is also broken down into 3A, 3B and 3C. Can you elaborate a little bit more on this as well?
Yeah, so in terms of keeping it simple, in the big picture, what stage 3 means is that there are lymph glands involved. And then breaking down between 3A, B and C is really just the degree to which the tumour again has grown into the bowel wall and how many lymph glands are involved. So the best case scenario would be, you know, which is what 3A is, would be that it's not grown deeply into the bowel wall, so the first one or two layers, and then only has a small number of lymph glands involved. And as we go towards 3C, then it means that the tumor has often grown right through the bowel wall, and again could be invading surrounding structures, but equally has a high number of lymph glands involved. And lymph gland staging is broken down into N1 and N2. So N1 is that you would have 1 to 3 lymph glands involved, and N2 would be that you have more than that you have 4 to 6. But within N2, it's broken down again, so that if you have 7 or more, you're considered N2 B rather than N2A. So it's quite complicated.
Okay, yeah.
But the big thing to remember is that if you have lymph glands involved, you are automatically a stage 3 cancer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just have a question that's outside this, but obviously people present at all different stages to get treated. Is it common for people to present at like a late stage, like 3 and 4, without having any signs and symptoms?
Yes. So we don't have long-term data yet from the screening, you know, since we have introduced screening here. But without a screening program, people generally need symptoms in order to present with their cancer, you know, to have a cancer diagnosis established. So if people have gotten to a stage where they have a lot of symptoms from the cancer, that's generally suggestive that it's already at a more advanced stage 3 or 4 cancer. And that goes for all cancers, really, that we don't have screening programs for. So the hope would be that with the establishment of the screening program, we pick up cancers before they're symptomatic and therefore more easily treated. But yes, in general, you know, in particular, I suppose, for patients who aren't captured with the screening program, they often do present with stage 3 cancers, where then the treatment is really ramped up.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much. And we might just discuss stage 4 as well.
So it's a little more simple in that it's defined as cancer that has spread beyond the local area where it started in the bowel and the surrounding lymph glands. So a cancer that involves a distant organ. And most commonly in colorectal cancer, this is the liver, the lungs and the peritoneum. But we can also see spread to the bones and the brain, for example, more rarely.
And does that tend to be just because they're the organs that are close by?
It's to do with the blood supply. Okay. So the blood that drains, the blood vessels that drain our colon are passed through the liver before going back to the heart. Whereas some of the rectal blood vessels actually can drain back towards the lung. And so it's more common in rectal cancer to see people with lung metastases. But both liver and lung metastases are very common in colorectal cancer in general.
Okay.
When it comes to treating colorectal cancer, what chemotherapy regimes are available to patients?
So in the adjuvant setting, we really are, the evidence is to use fluoropyrimidine, which is 5-fluorouracil or capecitabine, in that, you know, they are, so capecitabine is an oral prodrug of 5-FU and they have similar efficacy. And the other drug we use in combination is oxaliplatin. Mm-hmm. The 5-FU has been around for several decades now, and the addition of oxaliplatin in the early 2000s showed demonstrated improved outcomes in patients, and it became the new standard of care for patients who are fit for and have a good performance status for a combination treatment. I just, in terms of touching on the stage three patients where we absolutely consider adjuvant or preventative chemotherapy, there is more recent data looking at 3 months versus 6 months of chemotherapy, because obviously, as we all know, we see a lot of issues with neuropathy related to oxaliplatin, and it can be a really challenging thing for patients to deal with many years even after their treatment is finished. So as a community, we've become much more mindful of this problem, and that kind of really was the driver of looking to see would 3 months of treatment be equivalent to 6 months of treatment. This was a very complicated study, but the bottom line was that for patients who are considered to be lower risk stage three, so for example, a T3 tumor that is N1, so a small number of lymph glands involved, it looks that it's safe to give 3 months of chemotherapy instead of six. And at least the reassurance that if somebody is struggling with chemotherapy, that stopping it prior to completing 6 months of therapy is likely not to be detrimental to them. In patients who have what we consider higher risk stage three cancer, where they have a T4 tumor and several lymph glands involved, we do tend to still consider 6 months of chemotherapy. But again, when using capecitabine and oxaliplatin, it seems that even 3 months of this may be reasonable. It is a controversial area, but I would say that our practice has been more open to change in terms of shortening the duration of treatment in that group of patients. And in the studies that looked at this, they did see much less significant rates of long-term and grade 2 neuropathy in patients who had shorter durations of chemotherapy. So it's something to really be mindful of when we're treating patients. If they're getting significant neuropathy, to consider pulling back on the oxaliplatin component of treatment. Yeah.
And would there be any particular reason why you would choose capecitabine over IV 5-FU?
So in general, you know, the studies have always suggested that they're equivalent. Mm-hmm. I do feel that capecitabine, it can be less well tolerated, particularly in the older age group. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the hand-foot syndrome, which is where we get redness and soreness in the palms of our hands and soles of our feet, can be quite problematic. You know, as can diarrhea compared to when we give 5-FU. In in the States, they definitely recognize that people tolerate capecitabine less well, but believe that that may be related to folate supplementation actually in their diets, which we don't do in Europe and or in Asia. But particularly Asian patients seem to tolerate capecitabine better than Western populations, and so they use capecitabine a lot more there. What they weren't expecting in this collaboration, where they looked at 3 months versus 6 months of treatment, was that that it appeared that patients who got capecitabine and oxaliplatin or CAPOX, it was 3 months of treatment was safer than with FOLFOX, where we didn't see definitely that 3 months of FOLFOX was equivalent to 6 months. And this was a surprising finding. And there are many, thoughts and opinions put forward as to why that is. Mm-hmm. So only really, the main reason to consider capecitabine over 5-FU in the adjuvant setting would be if you're only going to do 3 months of treatment, that the data really is backing that up more than FOLFOX.
And another regime that we see quite a bit in colorectal cancer, myself and Anne-Marie will elaborate on it again in another episode, is FOLFIRI.
Yeah.
When do we decide to introduce FOLFIRI? Yeah.
So FOLFIRI and FOLFOX are also considered equivalent, but only in the metastatic setting. So we, in terms of when a patient is newly diagnosed with a stage 4 metastatic colorectal cancer, our general first treatment options are FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. It's really down to patient preference and factors which one you would choose first. For example, if a patient uses their hands a lot for fine movements, they're an artist or something like that, that you might want to avoid the oxaliplatin. Equally, if somebody is very concerned about losing their hair, you might want to avoid the irinotecan. So that's really just a patient discussion.
Yeah.
And irinotecan is really a drug that's only used in the metastatic setting. It hasn't been shown to be efficacious in the preventative or adjuvant setting. And then, what's important about treating metastatic disease is that patients see all of the drugs during their journey. So 5-FU, oxaliplatin, irinotecan, and then we have drugs that we use in later lines of treatment, which we'll touch on later. The one other kind of recent change or thing to consider in treating metastatic disease that's newly diagnosed is the combination of all three drugs, referred to as FOLFOX-IRI, which is obviously a more toxic regimen because we're using three drugs instead of two. But we sometimes might consider this in a young patient who has a right-sided tumor or a BRAF mutation, because there is data to suggest that patients who receive the more intensive regimen will have longer progression-free and overall survival, which basically means how long the cancer stays controlled, and patients benefit from this treatment.
Okay. And if you're younger, I suppose you would tolerate a more aggressive treatment a little bit more.
So you would only ever give this to somebody who has a very good performance status.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We might go into a little bit of the molecular testing for patients with colorectal cancer.
Yeah. So molecular testing is looking to find biomarkers. So a biomarker is something that will predict a response to a treatment and can drive our decisions around what treatments we should consider. So the main molecular testing in colorectal cancer present is aimed at detecting both Lynch syndrome another way of thinking about that is MMR testing. And that's really to define if a patient might benefit from immunotherapy. The other important biomarker that we look for in colorectal cancer present is RAS. This RAS is part of the EGFR pathway, and this can help guide whether patients will benefit from anti-EGFR antibodies. In recent years, next generation sequencing panels have become available, which really look to analyze a multitude of genes within a patient's tumor and try and identify if there are any genes there that may be targetable with a drug. So for example, we know now that HER2 is which is a gene a gene problem that can arise in breast cancer can also occur in colorectal cancer in a very small number of patients, probably about 3-4% of patients. But if we find that a patient has a HER2 gene abnormality, that opens up new drug treatment options for them. And so the idea of doing a next generation sequencing panel is that we might identify, we can cover all of the bases basically at once. Instead of just doing an MMR test for Lynch syndrome or a RAS test, we can do all of these tests, but in addition get as much information about the tumor as possible to guide, are there any more rare genes that we can also target. Right now, next generation sequencing is not something that's widely available in Ireland, but can be obtained on a compassionate use basis. It has become approved in the US recently, and so a lot of patients there with a colorectal cancer diagnosis are now going forward for this panel test of genes. And sometimes it can open up the option of a clinical trial looking at a new drug.
Okay. So you touched off the RAS test, and what does the KRAS and NRAS mutation mean?
So RAS is a component of the EGFR signaling pathway. So the EGFR signaling pathway is just a pathway in the tumor cell that, when it's stimulated by a protein that binds to the cell, the signaling in the pathway leads to downstream activation of other pathways that tell the cell to grow and divide. Okay, so if you can block this pathway, then it's a way of stopping tumor growth in its tracks. So a RAS mutation tells us that targeting the tumor with an EGFR antibody will not be helpful. So about 50 or 60% of patients will not have the mutation, which means they are wild type. And that means that they are candidates for additional targeted treatments. So if we get a profile of results back from the pathologist and we see that somebody is RAS wild type as opposed to RAS mutant, then that tells us that we have additional treatment options we can think about.
Okay. And just continuing on with the mutations, the BRAF mutation is something we see in colorectal cancer. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, so again, it is another component of this signaling pathway. I refer to the EGFR pathway. And it does not occur. So when we find a BRAF mutation, we generally will not find a RAS mutation also. Okay, so BRAF mutations occur when the patient is RAS wild type. They are rare, but are associated with generally a poorer prognosis. So they are a sign that the tumor might be more aggressive and less responsive to conventional treatments that we use. If a patient is RAS wild type but BRAF mutant, it actually tells us also that these targeted treatments will not be helpful, such as cetuximab and panitumumab. So it's an important piece of information to add to the puzzle. These patients are sometimes the ones where we will also consider the use of the triplet treatment of FOLFOXIRI. And sometimes there are identifiable factors that will make you suspicious that a patient could have a BRAF mutation. So they occur more commonly in tumors that are right-sided in the colon. In women, in people who are older, and they often are associated with spread to the peritoneum, as opposed to the liver and lung, for example. There are newer treatments which have been evaluated to try and specifically target the BRAF mutation. So most recently, there was a study combining a BRAF inhibitor called encorafenib with cetuximab, which the idea is that you're targeting both the RAS and the BRAF pathway at the same time, and that showed promising results. Again, these drugs are not currently a standard treatment that we are using, but hopefully they will come on track in the future.
Okay, brilliant. So you touched off cetuximab and panitumumab there, which are target therapies we would use a lot in the day ward. What should we consider when we're using these treatments?
So they can be very effective when used in the right population of patients in combination with chemotherapy. So they're, as I mentioned, they're targeted therapies rather than chemotherapy. But even though they are not chemotherapies, they still have important side effects to be aware of. With cetuximab, you can have infusion reactions. So patients receive pre-medications. The other particularly bothersome problems for patients are that they can cause quite a significant rash, which is most like an acne rash. And so we try to be proactive and start people on an oral antibiotic as a prevention to try and keep the rashes at bay as much as possible. And there are also creams we will prescribe to do this. The ironic thing about the rash is that if you develop the rash, it is felt to likely be predictive for a response to treatment. So the patients who get rash are most likely benefiting from the treatment, whereas patients who don't get a rash, unfortunately, that might suggest that they're not benefiting. The other side effect that we would see sometimes that can be quite problematic is diarrhea. And patients can also develop low magnesium levels, which we monitor in the day ward.
Okay. Yeah. We see Avastin used a little bit as well in colorectal cancer. When would we use Avastin?
So
we see Avastin used quite a bit in colorectal cancer. When would we use Avastin?
So Avastin, or also known as bevacizumab, is a drug that is not does not have a predictive biomarker to say that a certain population will benefit. So it's really open to anyone with stage 4 disease and can be used in combination with FOLFOX, FOLFIRI or FOLFOXIRI. And there is actually a study as well evaluating it at present in combination with TAS-102, which is one of the oral agents we will touch on later. So this is a monoclonal antibody which targets VEGF. And basically, to keep it simple, what this does is it blocks new blood vessel formation or angiogenesis. And if the tumor cannot obtain adequate blood supply, therefore it should inhibit tumor growth. So again, because it's not chemotherapy, it is not associated with your typical chemotherapy side effects, but there are some important, potentially serious side effects to consider. So patients who attend for bevacizumab or Avastin should always have their blood pressure checked because it can be associated with hypertension or high blood pressure. It can cause proteinuria or protein leak in the urine. So patients will always have a urine dipstick prior to proceeding with treatment. More significant but rarer side effects include wound healing issues. So it is recommended that anyone receiving Avastin, if they are due to undergo a surgical procedure, should have that drug held for approximately 6 weeks pre the procedure and post the procedure. You know, small procedures are potentially acceptable, but that should always be discussed. Other very serious complications can be blood clots or thromboembolism, which can happen most commonly in the legs or the lungs, bleeding, and then very rarely bowel perforations and fistula formation. So although rare, it's important to discuss these side effects with patients so that they can, you know, look out for them and notify us early if they think that there's a problem.
So all of the treatments we've discussed to this point have been intravenous treatments. Are there any oral therapies available for patients? And if so, when are they used?
So there are two main oral treatments approved in Ireland at the moment. The first is regorafenib and the second is TAS-102. And these are drugs that are taken a number of days or continuously on a particular schedule, and work very similarly to chemotherapy, you know, aiming to kill the cancer cells and reduce the tumor growth. They're generally used after the cancer has grown on FOLFOX and FOLFIRI. So what we refer to as the third line setting, where I guess, are getting to a point where we have less, we have more limited options. These drugs are you know, are still associated with chemotherapy type side effects. So it's important that patients still have a reasonable performance status or remain reasonably fit when you are thinking of prescribing them. The problem with these drugs is that they often are not associated with significant shrinkage of the tumor. And for most patients who receive these drugs, really what we see on subsequent scans is just is not just, but stable disease as opposed to shrinkage. Mm-hmm. And when patients do obtain stable disease or rarely shrinkage, often, unfortunately, the duration of that response is not very long. So we don't get as durable benefit from these drugs as we do from the chemotherapy drugs that are intravenous. Mm-hmm. In terms of other oral agents, I mentioned the HER2 gene, and some of the drugs that can target HER2 are oral drugs. And then, as I mentioned, you know, if we found a target on the next generation sequencing panels, some of those drugs would be oral as well. There is a very rare genetic alteration that we find called NTRK, N-T-R-K, which happens in 1% of all cancers and can be seen in colorectal cancer. And there is a drug which is called an NTRK inhibitor. There are a couple of these drugs that have emerged, and they have shown really exciting results across all cancers in terms of tumor shrinkage and prolonged disease control. So it's something that, even though it's very rare to find it in a patient with colorectal cancer, if you did find it on one of these gene panels, it could be hugely meaningful for that individual patient.
Mm-hmm. And the TAS-102 was the other name for that long surf.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you mind if we discuss a little bit about microsatellite instability? It's something that we see a little bit in some of the letters that are sent to us, but often kind of difficult to understand.
So microsatellite instability really goes hand in hand with MMR or mismatch repair. So it's basically the biological footprint of MMR. So mismatch repair is detected on the tumor sample, as you mentioned, through a process called immunohistochemistry, which is a pathology test that is done, you know, more quickly and more easily in the pathology lab. Whereas microsatellite instability is done with polymerase chain reaction. So it's a different way of testing, but it's telling you pretty much the same information, meaning that if you find an MMR problem or MMR deficiency, it's very likely that if you do MSI testing, you'll find microsatellite instability. So they go hand in hand. It's not 100% accurate in that, you know, rarely if you have an MMR deficiency and you undergo MSI testing or microsatellite testing, it will not always be 100% concordant, but the 95% of the time it is. So if we find somebody who is MMR deficient, they are generally referred for genetic testing for MSI, because this just has implications in terms of if it's inherited from your family or not, and therefore potential screening implications for both yourself and your family going forward. And any tumor that is MSI high, we always think about immunotherapy, because there have been very significant changes in the field in terms of the use of immunotherapy in these patients, where we've seen very dramatic and durable responses in comparison to chemotherapy. So now, following on from our most recent big conference at ASCO, it was shown that patients who received immunotherapy who are MSI high or MMR deficient upfront, so when they're newly diagnosed with metastatic disease, when they receive immunotherapy instead of chemotherapy, the responses and duration of response and how long the tumor is controlled for was much longer with immunotherapy than chemotherapy. And it will likely become the new standard of care treatment for this group of patients. It's important to say that when patients are diagnosed with an MMR deficient or MSI high tumor in the early stages, so stage 2 or 3, they're associated with a better prognosis and less chance of recurrence than patients who are MMR normal or microsatellite stable. So only about 4 or 5% of patients who have stage 4 colorectal cancer have MSI high or MMR deficiency. So, you know, only about 1 in 20 patients, if even, that you will test for, you'll find this. But again, for that group of patients, it's highly meaningful if you can, if it opens up the possibility of immunotherapy treatment.
Okay. And then I suppose just with regards to considering fertility with colorectal cancer, yeah. Is that something that needs to be considered when a patient is diagnosed?
Yes, so there are a number of ways that a colorectal cancer diagnosis can contribute to infertility. For a woman, scar tissue from surgery, particularly if they have a rectal tumor and the surgery is in the pelvis, can be problematic in terms of their ability to become pregnant. And indeed, if the tumor is very locally advanced, some women may in fact need to have their ovaries removed, which obviously would have huge implications for their fertility. In terms of the chemotherapy treatments themselves, there is actually quite limited data regarding how significant their impact is on infertility. But overall, studies are not hugely suggestive of the induction of infertility in comparison to some of our other chemotherapy regimens that we would use for testicular cancer or lymphoma or breast cancer, for example. Nonetheless, we would generally advise all patients who are, you know, or have not completed or started families and who are interested in doing so to undergo fertility preservation. The other strand to this is that patients who have rectal tumors often undergo radiotherapy. And again, radiotherapy will definitely increase the risk of long-term infertility. So it's more infertility issues may be more related to the surgery itself and radiation, and the chemotherapy element is somewhat unclear.
Brilliant. Amazing. Thank you so much, Megan. It's actually really clear just having it broken completely down like
yeah
that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah,
really appreciate your time.
Oh, I don't know if I'm explaining it right.
No,
I could listen to you all day. I feel like I absorbed so much in those questions. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate
it. I think it's
going to
benefit so many people. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
I'm happy to.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. If you have any questions on anything we've discussed, please feel free to email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to follow along and see more content about the podcast and our upcoming guests, you can follow us on Instagram at answersforcancers_podcast. Thanks for listening.